Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. Thank you for joining me for this, the 541st episode of School Sucks Podcast. Yeah, you know, our numbering scheme is a little weird. Sometimes there's a part A and a part B and a part C. So yeah, I know what you're saying. Brett, I was anticipating there was going to be some kind of gala here for the 500th episode in number. But the truth is, the real 500th episode of this podcast was 41 shows ago. So, you know, let's be honest with ourselves. Now, this is a special show because Patrick Byrne is such a great get as a guest. He's somebody that I've been meaning to get on the show for years at this point. If you don't know who Patrick is, he's the founder of Overstock.com, and he is also one of the most powerful voices in the United States when it comes to promoting school choice. Now, I know 540 episodes ago on this podcast, I said, we ain't into that. This is a show about freeing oneself from the damaging environment or damaging aftermath of the public school system. We are not going to get dragged into the morass of school reform. We are not going to get sucked into politics. But folks, here we are 8 years later, and we have been dragged and sucked in many directions I did not anticipate. Especially after, you know, conversations with many friends of mine here in New Hampshire. Kate Baker comes to mind. Kate has done a ton of work on creating educational opportunities. In fact, she used to work for the Network for Educational Opportunity, setting up scholarship funds and trying to create better educational settings for kids in New Hampshire. My dear friend Jason Osborne, who is a New Hampshire state rep, he sits on the education committee, and I've also had a couple conversations, both I think on the show and off the show, with Jody Underwood, who is one of the leading thinkers and doers here in New Hampshire on school reform up in the northern part of the state. She has been working hard in the belly of the beast for years to set up a voucher program. And today, I have arguably the most prominent voice in the country when it comes to educational choice, Patrick Byrne. So Patrick, in addition to being the founder of Overstock.com, is the chairman of the board for EdChoice, formerly the Milton Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice. Milton Friedman himself appointed Patrick his successor many years back. Now, EdChoice had its genesis in the mid-1950s when Milton Friedman started to promote the idea of using free market principles to improve public schooling. Now, a lot of us could argue that despite great minds like Milton Friedman's and Patrick Byrne's coming together to work on this project, in the end, it will be futile. The public schools cannot be reformed. They do exactly what they are supposed to do. Those are questions that I will put to Mr. Byrne on the show today. But I am just a podcaster, a former teacher, and somebody who tries to live the best I can the principles that I promote on this show. And I don't want to, through my naysaying, long history of naysaying here when it comes to school reform efforts and the politics of education, I don't want to undermine the efforts of people like Patrick, Jody Underwood, Kate Baker, the people like Osborne who bring a free market philosophy to New Hampshire educational politics. Through their work, these people have created better situations for individual students, and I think that that is worth noting. And before we get to that, it is just a short interview. I want to say I'm sorry about the lack of content recently. In fact, if you are a supporter of the show, either through Patreon or the AV Club, I have added a total of 5 hours of new content. My friend Andrew and I do this marathon of recounting our teen experiences. I was inspired to do so after I started to work on Jordan Peterson's past authoring program. You might remember I mentioned that to Kylon in the last episode. Also recently added, an impromptu conversation that I had back on Memorial Day with a couple of friends, including one who works as a researcher at a large public university in New Hampshire. And I tried to get him talking about campus culture. And it wasn't as in-depth as I originally had wished, but it definitely produced an hour of entertaining conversation. And of course, I also added a couple of casual conversations I recorded at Porkfest with our old friend Julia Trianskia. It was like midnight, I think, on Friday at Porkfest. And we sat in front of the hotel on these beautiful Adirondack chairs as Junebug after Junebug landed on our heads and our shoulders and our hands and our microphones and our knees. But don't worry, I took the time and the care to go through the audio and edit out all the parts where I go, oh my God, get this thing away from me! So you won't have to hear any of that in the show. Anyway, if you live somewhere else in the country and you don't know what a June bug is, it is a bug that I think weighs about as much as a golf ball. It has a very turgid exoskeleton, and it behaves like it's either drunk or blind. It comes zooming out of the dark and just can't seem to fly properly or navigate, and it just crashes into the skin of an innocent and unsuspecting human just trying to enjoy a summer night. But anyway, Julie and I got through it. We produced about an hour and a half of interesting conversation, including a little less than an hour talking about Julia's embrace of traditionalism. And I bring that up because Julia gets a lot of credit for making today's show happen. Julie and I were just hanging out Friday, and up to us walks Patrick Byrne, this man that I've been trying to track down and get on the show for years. And he seems very excited to see Julia. And I happen to be sitting right next to her. So in his mind, I must also be, some kind of important guy. And that's how it played out. We hung around for maybe an hour, hour and a half. We walked around the campgrounds. I told him about School Sucks and my experience as a teacher. We talked about higher education. We talked about some overlap in philosophy between School Sucks and EdChoice and some differences. And Julia said, you should go on Brett's show, Patrick. And Patrick agreed. And I was really pleased because, he's a very in-demand guy. So in his time, he was actually leaving midday on Saturday after he gave his talk. And there's all these people who want to interview him. So I wasn't really sure if it was going to happen or not. But, I was walking through the campground on Saturday at Porkfest. And, there he is the next day. And he says, Brett, the time has come for our interview. He didn't say exactly those words or talk anything like that, really. But that's how I felt about the exchange. So he and I walked to his cabin and we sat down at a table and we explored many of these topics. Now, it's short, but I was definitely appreciative that he was able to fit me in to a very, very busy day. Now, that was a tangent. I was trying to tell you, sorry for not having a lot of shows out lately. There are bonus shows. We went through that. I'm in between two trips right now. It was 4 days ago that I got back from the Porcupine Freedom Festival. It was an amazing time. I spent most of it with Rich and Lisa from Tragedy and Hope. Their friend, my new friend, we slept in a hotel room together. We're friends. Dylan from Connecticut, he's a great guy. Paul Verge came all the way from Vancouver. I don't know if some of you probably remember filmmaker Paul Verge. He was on the show years and years ago, and he was part of the Tragedy and Hope video series, What You've Been Missing. Now, by the time the weekend rolled around, we had quite a crew. It was me, Rich, Lisa, Dylan, Paul, Rich and Lisa's baby, who's one of the coolest dudes, plus School Sucks producer Mike, who's been doing a great job, and we've been working together for a few months. He hung around with us. A listener to both Peace Revolution Podcast and School Sucks named Phil, he hung with us. Another guy named John, who is an artist and actually made the Between Stimulus and Response print that I have hanging in the studio. I got to meet him, and I autographed some piece of art for him. An autograph. It was amazing. Now, with all these people around, not only can I pretend that this is like my entourage, but I'm also signing an autograph. I hope a lot of people saw all this. And I'll tell you, if you are like a B-list celebritarian, this is a really good event for bolstering your sense of self-importance. So I hope to see you there next year. Yeah, but through and through, just a great event. Richard Grove gave this presentation, what he called the economics of self-reliance, where he talked about the process of growing a podcast or a media project into a successful online business. I got to introduce him, which was definitely an honor. I've been following Rich's work for a decade. And I've been a participant in the voluntarist libertarian world for about a decade, and I was excited to be able to get up on stage and bring those two worlds together for the first time. Even though Rich has been going to Porkfest for a number of years now, and he's made quite an impact with his wit and his smarts and his generosity. He's also done a bunch of interviews that got a lot of play on YouTube. But it was a very cool experience for me to get up on the stage and welcome him to, you know, a Porkfest speaking spot for the very first time. Next week, after the 4th of July, one day after the 4th of July, I'm flying to Portland, Oregon, to secure my spot as one of the first 15 guests, you know, the illustrious first 15 guests on Thaddeus Russell's Unregistered podcast. Tell me what you'd like to hear us discuss. I'm interested. It's definitely going to be revealing in ways that I have not been revealing on School Sucks yet. It's also worth pointing out, this is my first face-to-face conversation with Thaddeus Russell since the winter of 2013. It's the first time he's ever interviewed me. We've done, 20, 25 shows together. Every one is me interviewing him. So this is going to be very interesting. Now, why would a man up and fly across the country all of a sudden to be on Unregistered? Well, I mean, I think it's a great opportunity. The show is doing phenomenally. He's getting tens of thousands of downloads per episode. But we're getting together for a couple of days out there because we've got things to discuss. We've got an event coming up in Salem, Massachusetts in just 5 weeks, and there are still tickets left. It is called A Weekend with Thaddeus Russell. After years of online contention, we bring the School Sucks community face-to-face with Thaddeus Russell for the first time. Lots of opportunities for discussion, debate, socializing, sightseeing. I am so excited for this weekend. I'm so excited to meet all of the people already on the guest list. I hope you will add yourself to it. You can go to ThaddeusRussell.com/courses. Select A Weekend with Thaddeus Russell and get your tickets. Like I said, there are seats left, but time is running out. I just promoted the shit out of this at Porkfest for days. All right, that's it. Before we get started today, I'm going to leave you with some audio of Milton Friedman from 1996. This is him addressing supporters at the Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice. I don't include this because I think people in the audience are going to agree with Friedman's vision or all of his word choice. But I think this audio will be helpful in understanding his assessment of the problems and his solutions for those problems as they stood about 20 years ago. Now, Milton Friedman is very interesting. He has a lot of really tremendous things to say about a variety of economic issues when it comes to the state versus choice. With the left, Milton Friedman has become a kind of lightning rod for what are described as, and we actually, we talked about this in the academic conformism series with Thaddeus Russell recently, this idea of neoliberalism, something that grew in the middle of the 20th century out of the University of Chicago. So this is often referred to as the Chicago school of, finger quotes, free market economics, often at odds. Now, of course, as far as the left is concerned, there's massive conflation and there's really no difference with the Austrian school. So Friedman, to a certain extent, was influenced by Austrian thinkers like Hayek, but Friedman's vision, not just on education, but on a variety of, you know, the state versus free market issues, was that there could be this insertion of free market principles into these admittedly coercive institutions, and that would soften the palpability of that coercion, or even as competitive forces took hold, remove that coercion entirely. There would have to be a new way forward. And this was kind of informing his vision of school choice, that creating competition would solve the ills of the government schools. So this is where a lot of us, you know, over the many years of talking about these issues on the show, a lot of us depart from Friedman at this point. I have not been sold on the idea that you can insert competition in choice and respect for individuality into systems that, even if they are not specifically designed to stamp those things out, most of the machinery works against, obviously, the promotion or the embrace of those things. And most of the people involved in, you know, government institutions like schooling are incentivized against embracing or promoting those things. Now, of course, I'm always willing to learn more, and that is one of the reasons for the show today. I am interested in freeing as many individuals as possible students and parents from the government school system. And even though I have not been sold on, you know, the voucher programs or the school choice solutions, I'm certainly willing to accept it as a step in the right direction. And I also want to be appreciative of the work that people are doing towards that end. Here we go.
We have great opportunities in this world that arise out of the enormous technological developments of the last few centuries, as well as out of the political developments. Worldwide, countries are leaving the idea of central direction of government control and moving into the free market area. We have a tremendous opportunity, but we will not be able to take advantage of it if so many of our students are functionally, so many of our adults are functionally illiterate. Now, it's not always been that way, by no means. Rose and I both went to public schools and got what we regarded as a good education. And that's probably true of many of the people in this room. You too went to public schools. But things are different today. They are not what they were when Rose and I were going to school or when many of you were going to school. They're not what they were for many reasons. They're not what they were because of social developments, changes in culture, changes in attitude. But one of the most important reasons why they're not what they were is because of the extent to which you have had a shift of responsibility for schools from local people, from the parents in the community, to distant bureaucrats, supposed professional educators, and teachers' unions. When Rose and I were in school, there were 150,000 school districts in this country. Today, there are 15,000 for a population that is twice as large. From a large number of small districts which were in competition with one another, and where parents and local people had something to say, our governmental educational system has moved in the direction of large aggregates controlled from the State Department, from the state capital, or from the federal government. In addition, the schools have become a monopoly run by the teachers' unions. Like it or not, that's the case of our so-called public schools. 90% of the kids in this country are going to public schools. They should not be called public schools. They should be called government schools. They're government schools run by the teachers' union. The people who run the school have very little incentive to satisfy their captive customers. They don't have to pay any attention to their students because their students are captives. They've got to go there. They have nowhere else to go. And they have every incentive to make life easier for themselves. It may surprise you to know that the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, between them, certainly the strongest and most important pressure group in this country, those two agencies have more than 3,500 staff members, each receiving more than $100,000 in wages and benefits. That's an amazing figure. Where does the money to pay those wages and benefits come from? It comes from you, the taxpayers, indirectly through the teacher salaries, part of which they have to turn over to the teachers' union. I say have to, because in most places of the country, you have a closed shop, a union contract. And unlike most industries, the union is not bargaining with the people who are spending their own money. They're talking about somebody else's money, the taxpayers' money. And that doesn't exercise the same kind of restraint. The French say, cherchez la femme. The economist says, look for the incentive. If you want to know what people are going to do, don't talk to them, don't ask them what they say, but see what it is in their self-interest to do, and that's what they'll do. So in order to change this situation, we have to change the incentives of the people who now run the system. How can we do that? The way to change the incentives is to empower parents so that they can choose the schools their children attend. More than 40 years ago, I suggested that if a parent chose to send his child to a private school, he or she is saving the government the cost of schooling that child, and he should be received a sum, a voucher. I didn't use the word voucher there, but that's what's come to be called. He should receive a sum equal to at least part of what he's saving the government. It's really a tax rebate, because The money that is going to school the children is coming from the taxpayers. But if a parent chooses to send a child to a private school, that parent has to pay twice, once in the form of tuition and once in the form of taxes. That's a very unjust and undesirable system. If indeed every parent had a voucher which would enable him to choose a school his child goes to, you would have a major market for new and innovative approaches to schools. The public schools would have to meet the competition or risk losing their students. The result of it would be that the public schools would improve. They would no longer have a monopoly. Just consider what has happened in other areas of our society when we have broken a monopoly. Telephones used to be a monopoly. They no longer are. And there has been an enormous improvement in the quality, the cost of telephone services. The post office used to have a monopoly, in effect, even on partial delivery and on special delivery. They no longer do. UPS, Federal Express, and a host of other services have shown how you can innovate in that area. Wherever you look, government monopolies share one characteristic. They produce a low-quality product at a high cost. That's just as true of government monopolies in the United States as it was of government monopolies in the Soviet Union. It's the nature of the beast. If you could have such a revolution, and a revolution it would be, if every parent had the same freedom of choice than most of those in this room and we do for their children, the benefits would go well beyond the students who would receive a better education. There's much talk about a decline in values. There would be an enormous improvement in values if we had the kind of educational system we can imagine. Today, you have a socialist educational system. And a socialist educational system will teach socialist values. A free market educational system will teach free market values. Every system reflects its basic nature. We're impressed with a number of groups around the country that are experimenting with different approaches to improving the quality of schooling. We believe that the best way to achieve effective schooling is through universal parental choice through educational vouchers, that's the best way to assure a truly equitable and innovative school system. However, maybe we're wrong. To borrow from Chairman Mao, let 100 flowers bloom, and let competition, not authority, decide which will develop. Our foundation will welcome all attempts, and we hope to cooperate with as wide a range of educational reformers as possible. Free competition is the best way to find out what works best, not only in the automobile industry, not only in drugs, not only in television, but also in the field of schooling. Thank you.
Patrick Byrne, welcome to School Sucks Podcast.
It's an honor to be on, Brett. What an aptly named show.
Thank you very much, and welcome to Porkfest. I was curious about what you were here to do this year.
I'm here to give a talk. They asked me to come sort of every couple of years to just give a talk. I will be closing down the festival today with a talk.
Right. So we were talking before we started recording, and you said you were still kind of forming this. And I'm noticing that it's an hour and a half away. So I'm impressed that's quite a feat to, in that time, put together a presentation and get on stage in front of probably what will be the largest crowd here and deliver. But you must do this pretty regularly, right?
Yeah, about once a week. And it's the same. I'm like an old storyteller who's told the same, old sailor who's got the yarns. And what I really view myself is the griot of this tribe. Mm-hmm. In West Africa, each tribe has its griot, is an old man or old woman, mm-hmm, who's the oral historian of the tribe, who tells the story, the history of the tribe, and tells and retells those stories to the youths and to the people to remind them who they are, and they understand their narrative. And we philosophical liberals, we have a history, and I think I'm slowly turning into the storyteller of our tribe's histories. Mm-hmm. And if I have any positive function here, and I'm not sure I do, it's at least I can do that.
So you were talking about the Republican Party's origins in New Hampshire?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, and you feel like that's an important kind of legacy for this community to appreciate, and why so?
As long as they're here, yes, they should understand the seminal role that New Hampshire played in the elimination of slavery.
Yeah,
the pro, you know, the what happened, the pro freedom movement. Our pro-freedom movement really began here, and they, well, shouldn't say began here, but certainly the Republican Party started here. A fellow named Amos Tuck, and at Dartmouth, there's the Amos Tuck School of Business. And it's because there were two forms of, you know, there were the Democrats who were pro-slavery and the Whigs who were against it, but there were two ways of being against it. One was sort of a compromising, wishy-washy way of being against it, and the other was a more aggressive way. And the Whigs basically had adopted the moderate course.
Right.
And then in 1854, with the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So the moderate course was the Missouri Compromise, 1820, where Maine was admitted as a state along with Missouri, one state, one free, one slave. And the deal was going forward, it would always be two by two. And 34 years later, 1854, that deal got broken, Kansas-Nebraska Act. And that's when some people said this Whig stuff isn't going to cut it, and they broke off, and they met in a tavern in Franconia Notch. This is what made me think of this. I was driving up here yesterday. I see Franconia Notch. I remember this old story. They met in a tavern there, and they said, we're going to form a new party. And that was Amos Tuck. And some weeks later, he went down to Exeter and formally did it. But it actually began a little tavern in Franconia Notch.
You know, it's amazing. Like, I grew up in New Hampshire. I went to school in Exeter, and we never learn any of this. You know, the history is very, very sanitized. And that's unfortunate, because this is an incredible area. I mean, like, right down into Massachusetts. And I think a lot of people live here their whole lives, and they don't really appreciate it. They see, I mean, it's all around them. It's alive in many ways, but they don't get any
You know,
understanding of what they're in the midst of.
Well, I used to describe New Hampshire. I'm from New Hampshire. I grew up around New England, but basically Vermont and New Hampshire are my home states. And out in the country, I always say I'm from New Hampshire, and people say, oh, live free or die, and chuckle. But yeah. And I'd always say, no, this is like the last Jeffersonian democracy in the country. You know, it has this great pro-liberty tradition in the 80s and such. I'd say it's lost its edge in the 90s. I think we probably had maybe some influx from other states where people don't understand liberty, and they flee the other state because things aren't going well, things go bad there. They come here, and then they recreate.
They follow the same impulses.
Yeah, not understanding that those are the rules that created the problems, they fled.
Yeah, absolutely. And Massachusetts, they sort of cross that wall into New Hampshire once they find the tax situation oppressive. And then, you know, they spend a year here, and they feel very uncomfortable with the comparative freedom. And they, you know, they go to their legislatures, and they start asking for more government. It's unfortunate. Yeah, and you're right. It's been a phenomenon for like 30 years here at least.
It's changing the tone. Same thing happened with Vermont. I remember Vermont in the 60s, and then there were a lot of people who fled New York, and they settled down and created, you know, glass-blowing businesses or something in Vermont. But they brought the same big government ideas, and it changed the character of Vermont. And it's funny, they flee the high taxes, but they get there and say, well, we want the big government programs, not understanding that New Hampshire already ranks on all kinds of measures of human flourishing, like education and longevity, health, as child mortality and such, as it's always in the top first, second, third, or fourth states on just about everything you can measure. And they do that on no income tax, no sales tax. No,
right.
You know, they do it on this minimalistic government, and yet people don't get the joke. That's why.
Right. Right. That's why you cross over the, you know, on 93, these beautiful paved roads. And New Hampshire needs them paved for like the ski traffic, right? As soon as you go over that border into Massachusetts, it's like you're driving a buggy on the surface of the moon. How quickly the roads deteriorate, and where there's so much more tax money going towards that.
Right. But then they get here and they see it like this, and they say, well, gee, if it's this good with the low taxes, think how much better it would be if we could make it a high tax state.
Right. Right. So one of the things that I've really been meaning to reach out to you about for years at this point, it was very convenient that I happened to just run right into you yesterday, and we talked about it a little bit, is education. And this is one of the things you're involved in New Hampshire, as well as like 30 other states you mentioned.
Yes.
Let's start with a broad picture, and then maybe we can laser in from there. What's your vision for education in this country?
Well, my vision is that we move it from being driven from the top down and do and reorganize it so it's driven by the by choice, just like all our other great industries. And so there can be innovation and such. If you have an industry, say the Soviet agricultural model, where you've got planters in Moscow giving orders to somebody growing peas out near Vladivostok, there's no, a top-down system like that always is an abomination.
Right.
And it's only when you reorganize from the point of view of demand. There's no way to fix a top-down system. As a guy who runs a 2,000-person company, and there's no way, I mean, I'm constantly involved in trying to fix and prevent bureaucracy. There's no way to do it from the top down. You have to drive things from the bottom. And what that means is, where decisions can be taken from the feds and moved to the state, they should be. When they can be taken from the state and moved to the county, they should be. Where they can be taken from the county and moved to the district, they should be. When they can go from the district to the school, they should be. But most crucially, and this is the skit step people miss, when they can be taken from the school and put in the household.
Indeed. As it once was.
Yes.
You know, there were riots when they tried to set this system up in the 1800s. People were stunned that some would be willing to turn control of their children over to the government. And let me ask you a related question about
that. You know
what
justification for that was in the 1800s?
They tried out a few of them. Immigration was one of them.
That was the big one. It was Horace Mann, the father of the public education, wrote these essays and such where he was specifically, it was directed at, we have these sort of dirty Catholic immigrants from Southern Europe who aren't going to get it. We need a system to indoctrinate them.
They have other loyalties.
Yeah. They're dirty papists, you know, you can't trust them. And we're going to indoctrinate that. And so that was the design of the public school system. And it kept that basic ideological, it kept that function, even though the governing ideology has changed to being something else, but they've kept that function as it. And what really offends people about the prospect of designing the system or allowing it to the parents more choice is they will lose that ability they have to use it to enforce it.
As a tool of social engineering and scientific management.
Correct.
Which is like it went through all these different phases. You know, it starts with, I guess, this anti-immigration religious crowd that is embodied by Horace Mann. They go over and they pretty much, you know, he might have thought he had good intentions, but they went over and pretty much pretended to look at the schools in Prussia and say, yeah, this works. This is good. We can use this to forward our democratic institutions. And, you know, it didn't work. So then the John Deweys come around and they do their reform movement for their progressive purposes. And then the behaviorists get a hold of it. And then the globalists get a hold of it. And that's just the phases of that system over the course of, you know, 120 years. So it can only always.
Exactly.
It can only be that, right? So when I hear people talking about school reform in any form, including school choice, assuming that the public system continues to exist. How do you feel about the nature of the school itself? Can it become, by localizing it, can it become something else without completely leveling it and starting, you know, from scratch?
Well, it could evolve to something else.
Okay.
But if it can be, if it can receive feedback and input, and the only way to do that is you allow children to defect, and you put the money, you just separate the question of government funding of education from government delivering the good. You know, we have, for example, we have food stamps in our society. We think that it's good to provide, you know, that poor people can eat. But if somebody said, hey, let's make a rule that says poor people have to spend their food stamps at a government-run supermarket.
Yeah.
We'd all say, gee, what edge does the government have in running a supermarket? Leave that to the private market. Well, similarly, what makes let's think the government has some special edge in running the schools. They can provide the funding, but the evidence is overwhelming. The private market can do it better for half the price.
Right.
I mean, that seems to be what we figured out. So what are the steps that you've taken and what obstacles have you encountered? Let's use New Hampshire as an example, because that's where I've been most involved. And how long does the process go back? Like, when did you actually start this?
Well, the man who started this was Milton Friedman, first of all. He started in 1955. He wrote a paper in an economic journal proposing this is the right thing to do with the American school system. In 1996, he basically took he designed his household finances. So his money, he created a foundation, he and Rose, the Milton and Rose Friedman Foundation for School Choice. And that became the great think tank and intellectual center of gravity fighting for school choice in America.
Mm-hmm.
He organized so his own personal wealth went into that upon his death. And so I joined it in about 2001, I think,
mm-hmm.
2001. And then when he died in 2006, he named me his successor. And that said we could use his name for 10, his and Rose's name for 10 years. So we were the Friedman Foundation for School Choice. We recently, he wanted it such that after 10 years, the name got changed because there's all kinds of dangers with what happens with, and he knew the power of his name.
Yeah. Okay.
And so it was changed last year to EdChoice. And it's also sort of, it's a shorter name. So EdChoice is the intellectual center of gravity of the school choice movement, of which we think, let me just define the school choice movement for a second.
Absolutely.
Sort of the most baby step you can make is what they call backpack funding in California. If your kid is in Oakland, you can go to any public school in Oakland and the money goes with them. The next step is a chart towards freedom as a charter school and still public school, but it's a step towards more parental choice. The next step is vouchers and ESAs. And ESAs, educational savings accounts, are up in available in New Hampshire. I mean, the bill is passed the Senate, and it is before the House in the fall. And I think that New Hampshire can shoot to the front of the reform pack. If New Hampshire passes that bill, the benefit it will have both in terms of improving the education of kids here, creating an incredible school environment here, and drawing companies. The number of companies who would be attracted to setting up a facility in New Hampshire if their workers know they can get, take part in ESAs, I think it would be an extraordinary move for New Hampshire.
Absolutely. So you have actually worked with, I think, one of my past guests, Jody Underwood.
Oh, sure. Oh, Jody.
Up in Croydon, right. New Hampshire. So what has that project looked like, just to use a specific case study from your vantage point?
Well, I'm not fluent in the legal details, but basically there was what has happened in New Hampshire a couple times has been the system, the bureaucracy begrudgingly gives way a little bit. Like in the 1990s, a law was passed that said basically people could set up charter schools and receive funds from the state once they had approval.
Right.
And so it got through the legislature against big opposition from the teachers union. And they said, okay, the law was on the books, but then last I checked, 15 years had gone by and they had never approved a school. So, you know, the law is on the books, but they just never let anyone actually do it. And in Croydon, the legal details of the case are beyond me, but at the moment, but it was a case where Jody went through that. They have 700 people there in Croydon. They had a contract with another town to provide the school. That school was doing badly. They got out of the contract, followed all the rules, applied to the state for the ability to basically to do their own voucher program. And while technically the law allowed it and the state approved it, as soon as they tried to put it into practice, the bureaucrats came in and put the kibosh on the whole thing. She's been fighting 7 years through the court system, and I think she's coming up to the final round. I think they're on the way to the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. Now, related to vouchers, do you see, or is there any discussion about a way of co-opting the voucher system for the public employee unions? Like, let's say this money goes out. I mean, this has always been my big concern with vouchers. And I'm sure there's a way around it, but I just don't know what it is yet. That if this money is reallocated to private schools through vouchers, right, the public employee unions, and maybe even with the support of school administrators and, you know, school apologists in the political class, they would say, well, look, if we're going to take public money and, you know, send it to private institutions, we should have, the state should have control over those private institutions. I mean, that seems like a real concern.
That is a risk. That has that's a threat. There's a threat of that happening. It hasn't really happened in the U.S. Has happened in Denmark with vouchers, which has a long tradition of vouchers. You know, and I think that would just be something we would have to fight. But it would, whatever we did, they'd at least having to be fighting for that kind of control, where at this point they have it handed to them by having control of the public school system. They have that ideological control.
Absolutely.
And also you can do it. It's the nature. Some of these school choice programs are organized such that the money never actually leaves the taxpayer's pocket into the state. And
oh, wow.
You get a tax credit. That's another way of doing it. And so that would weaken the argument that you just described. But vouchers are, I mean, that's a risk, but so far it hasn't happened yet.
So everywhere you've tried this, what is the best example of success, and what is the worst example of obfuscation or opposition?
Success, take the DC voucher program, which has been around long enough, they can track. There's been 18 academically published peer-reviewed journal articles on the effects of school choice, and that under the gold standard of scientific research and social science is a random assignment study. And at this point, you know, it used to be that a voucher program would start and the kids would do better and people would say, yeah, but those kids were more motivated to get the vouchers, so it doesn't count. So now for every time a voucher opens up, there's 5 kids who apply for it.
Yeah.
So you can have a random, you know, one gets it randomly. And so he gets the, or she gets the vouchers, the others don't. And then you just track them, how they do over 10 years. And it turns out the rates at which they graduate go way up, like into the 90%. The rate at which they go to college goes way up. The parental satisfaction with the school system goes in DC. It went from like 20 to 90 for the people in this program, which is why, incidentally, it's a very strange thing. It's one of these issues that divides the Democratic Party, just as it does the Republican on different grounds. But in the Democratic Party, the Latino and Black vote is overwhelmingly for vouchers. 70-72% of Latino and Black families with a child of school age years believe in support vouchers, mm-hmm. where the rest of the Democratic Party, which is heavily owned by the NEA, the Teachers Association, one-fifth of all the delegates to the Democratic Convention are NEA members, they're dead set against it. And on the Republican side, there's a different split. But so it's really something that could really split off the a lot of minority vote and make from the Democratic Party and make Republican candidates attractive.
Understood. So what are the talking points? I mentioned opposition before. What are the talking points they're even trotting out to try and argue against vouchers when you have this public support, when the numbers are starting to come in over the course of a decade and you're seeing the positive long-term results of creating these opportunities for school children? How are they still lining up against this? I mean, we know why they're lining up against this, but how are they selling that or trying to sell that to the public?
They make a bunch of irrational points, but that have some public appeal. They say things like, well, this is draining money from the public school systems, to which the correct answer is, it's draining revenue, but it's also draining expense, and it's draining a lot more expense than it drains revenue. So it actually leaves the public school system better off. If you can relieve it of 10% of the load on it and only take 5% of the funds, it actually leaves this school more money per student left behind.
Just on the surface, it seems hard to believe, because like if you talk about draining expense, right, you're taking students away. That would be the expense.
Right.
But it seems like, and we talked about this briefly yesterday, the cost per classroom. We find, and this is also the case with higher education, that most of the money is winding up in administration anyway. So taking kids, we've had these sort of thought experiments in New Hampshire for 7 or 8 years now, like how many kids would have to, you know, pull out of a school district before they, or a school, before they couldn't justify their budgets anymore. But just pulling kids out of a school doesn't affect the cost of the administration. So how does that work exactly?
To that, I would raise two objections.
Okay.
I would say one, I used to work for Warren Buffett. And mm-hmm. Warren Buffett taught me there is no such thing as a fixed expense. People will tell you that there is, but there really isn't. There's a spectrum of and on that spectrum, there are expenses that can be cut, but they take you 2 years to cut, like leases and things like that. And there are expenses that can be cut in 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. And everything's on that spectrum. But there is no such thing as a permanently fixed expense, which means that you have to hack the bureaucracy away, what they call the fixed expense. Secondly, I would say your argument is not the argument teachers make when you add new students to a school. When you add new students, they say, oh, we have 10 new students. We need another $90,000.
Right.
That's how it works. You can't say that, but oh, if you take 10 away, it doesn't save us anything. They can't have it both ways.
Right.
You know?
And because if it just stayed the same, you have these fixed expenses that are not really fixed. They appear to be fixed. And, you know, I think that if there is anything that approaches a kind of fixed expense, it's public money into these bureaucracies.
Did you know that 100 years ago, this country had 100,000 school districts? Now we have 15,000.
Right. So the centralized.
Everything's been centralized and agglomerate, you know, so these institutions of being a school district filled with people who, you know, do no. Well, you've been a teacher.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when I was a kid, the school was a, you know, you had the principal, the teachers, and a couple secretaries and such, and they made the and administrators in the school work. Now you've got the all the. Well, what, you know, what else do they have in there that's an expense?
As far as personnel? Oh, it's ever expanding. And they have a lot of these. Well, I mean, they're also getting federal money for a lot of this personnel, too, for some of these special programs.
So you have a staff at the district headquarters, a staff of program coordination, and a staff of curriculum evaluation, and a staff of this and that. And
exactly.
No evidence it does any good. A lot of evidence it actually harms it.
Indeed. Absolutely. So the state of higher education. I know you went to Dartmouth. That's actually the area that I live in. Dartmouth, fortunately, seems to be immune from a lot of what we're watching happen nationally. But what are your thoughts on the college culture of the second decade here in the 21st century?
I find it's unbelievable what I'm reading, that the college culture. I have a number of advanced degrees, and I was lucky. I think Dartmouth is different because Dartmouth attracts a lot of kids who are into nature, and people who are into nature and outdoors tend to be reality based and not ideology based. But mm-hmm. it's unbelievable, shocking to me that I see that there's an anti free speech movement at colleges now, and they just don't get it. They don't get how, you know, they come to college thinking they know everything, and their role at college is to tell adults what they know, mm-hmm. and anyone who doesn't agree is a racist, or anyone, and they can't be allowed to speak. And it's just really, it's like the Red Guards.
Where do you see that going? From your experience, like we're trying to figure out where is this going to be in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years? I mean, obviously this kind of culture isn't sustainable. So, but you've been around and you've been through maybe some versions of this before, even maybe as a student. Where do you see this ending up?
Well, what it will do, you know, Yogi Berra said something that can't go on forever will stop.
Yeah.
At some point, parents are going to, you know, why kids are leaving college with $200,000 debts so they can earn a degree in grudge studies,
which actually
provides, they have no idea how to increase their value in the marketplace. They're never going to be able to get out from under the debt. It's a terrible economic choice. And they or their parents are going to start seeing that. It will turn back on itself. And then there's other programs. I've just been hearing this morning about a company called Praxis.
Indeed.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I'm so impressed with what I've heard. I can't wait to research them. That they can take somebody in 3 months and turn them into, you know, a person who can add value in the marketplace. And how the world works, they don't understand. It's not like there's this big pot of value out there that some government agents get to whack up, although that's how they imagine life is.
Right.
How life really is you go out and you try to create value, and you get a share of the value you create. And you can argue about what share it is, but you get with your boss, but you get a share of the value you create. If you go into a job setting thinking that your mindset is, gee, what am I entitled to? it's just the wrong choice. You should go into a job setting, think about how can I bring value to this organization? And if I do, if it's a good organization and a good competitive organization, smart, in which they all need to be these days, they will then recognize you and find a way to share that value so as to keep you and such. And that's the way the world actually, what employers look for.
Absolutely. Well, Patrick Byrne, thank you so much for your time. I'm glad I finally got you on the show here.
Brett, it's been my honor. Thank you.